예. All right. Going to do something rare here. Haven't done before. Doing a kind of podcast doubleheader. A little baseball terminology. Did one earlier today on female, sex addiction, women's infidelity. Talked a little bit about Michelle Langley, her book, Women's Infidelity, Living in Limbo. And I had it in mind the whole time. I was going to do more sort of case illustrative kind of ideas, but you know, the truth is, ran out of time, sort of managing time here, and could only do sort of half hour slots. I knew I was going to run out of time. I knew I needed more time than half an hour or whatever it was to talk about, you know, this subject. And maybe I could have made this an hour, but this is just and waited for another day. Didn't want to. Wanted to do it today. So today is going to be the second half of this podcast. I'm going to do part one, part two. Put them out together. We'll see how it goes. Okay. Hi again. I'm Graham Daniels. This is Getting Real About Sex Addiction. The podcast series been going here for about a year and a half. I think I might be closing in on 60 podcasts here. I've had a few guests. Mostly it's been me. A few times my co-author, Joe Farley. Co-author because, you know, we wrote a book together, which we began in 2019. That's a long time ago. We got published through Roman and Littlefield. So check it out. It's called Getting Real About Sex Addiction, A Psychodynamic Approach to Treatment. And in the book, we focus mostly on male sex addicts because that's what the field focuses mostly on, basically. Depending on who you ask, they represent sort of 90% of the people who at least present, you know, for treatment. And usually they present for treatment in the aftermath of what's called a discovery event. That's sort of psych jargon, I guess, for the onset of the onset of the problem in the sense of it's becoming out of the closet. You know, somebody has gotten discovered. It's a, you know, terrible event and a trauma for impacted partners. You know, another podcast is about all of those kind of subjects. Meanwhile, and I've been working in this field, I should just back up and say, since the late 90s, roughly, mostly in outpatient settings, private practice offices with respect to sex addiction or problem sexual behaviors, if you prefer. I've worked in chemical dependency programs that were more hospital-based otherwise, but in private practice mostly, with respect to the topic of this podcast and mine and Joe's book. And I have treated a fair number. I'm thinking it's hard to represent in terms of numbers. Two dozen, roughly, women who would have identified as sex addicts or something close to it in that period. And I mean treated them in the way that I talk about in this podcast series, in an in-depth psychoanalytic way. Some of those patients, call them patients, not clients in my world, for longer than a year. Some shorter than that period of time. But not many, and maybe there's some extra that would fall into the category of women that I've consulted with, you know, just two or three times, and maybe they go in a different direction, maybe. And that's not to count all the, you know, people, women and men, I guess, who might have become patients but didn't want to do an in-depth approach, chose to do something else, what have you. I wanted to talk about, you know, female sex addiction from or women's problem sexual behaviors in the context of the book that I drew attention to in the last podcast, Michelle Langley's, you know, Women's Infidelity. Her book is not about sex addiction per se, but it, I will sort of dovetail her material, you know, with some of mine. Again, one of the it's startling, perhaps. Interesting to know whether the listener is startled by this. Pieces of data that she builds upon is this data that 70 to 75% of divorces are initiated by women. It's this idea that I think is, you know, maybe talked in and around in different circles over the years, that this chestnut belief that makes this a little bit surprising, perhaps because the chestnut belief is that men are the ones who resist marriage. Men resist marriage on the front end, we might think. They tend to not be so resistant on the back end, meaning later down the line. To get married is to, you know, curtail man's sexual freedom. You know, the last night of freedom, the bachelor night and all that. You know, marriage is, the joke is that sort of an end to that. Whereas women covet marriage is the narrative there. They covet the white dress, all that comes with it. They are raised to, you know, look forward to marriage, to prepare for it. It's the biggest day of their life, you know, at least. You know, I remember an acquaintance once, you know, talking to him and his fiance, and casual conversation about the planning that was going into their weddings, and the man, an ordinarily, you know, decent guy with, you know, perhaps the odd element of sexism that would betray itself from time to time, he just sort of shrugged and says, you know, weddings are all about the women. It's all about what they want. And a kind of background to that comment was the idea that marriage was something that, you know, women want and that men don't necessarily want up front. But what about much later? What about the disillusionment that, you know, women perhaps have with marriage that men have less of, perhaps, in numbers? You know, men come to appreciate marriage to and more resistant to it coming to an end than women's are. Maybe that's one of the premises in Michelle Langley's book, Women's Infidelity. And I've treated lots of women in relationship, and here's how her experience, what she's supposing, you know, dovetails with mine somewhat. I, of the all the women I've treated who were reporting at least problem sexual behaviors, they were having affairs. Some were looking at porn, you know, anonymous partners. I think maybe on just one or two occasions they were, you know, paying for sex, but that was more rare. One of the things that was notable is that with rare exception, they weren't there on the back of a discovery event. They weren't in treatment on the back of a, you know, discovery event. They hadn't been caught. You know, there was no, you know, partner sitting next to them, you know, indignantly, you know, jabbing a finger at them and saying, what are we going to do about this? You know, and you have a problem. And, or even doing that thing which a lot of, you know, impacted partners do, impacted partners being dominantly heterosexual women in my experience. You know, calling up, even making the reconnaissance calls towards treatment providers and, you know, asking the questions on behalf of the shame-faced other. No, the women that I've treated appeared, you know, by themselves. They made the calls on by themselves on their on their own behalf. And they presented, you know, before me wanting to talk about, you know, their sexuality. They want to talk about their affair-seeking behavior, their porn usage, all the things that, you know, they were doing secretively, mostly secretively, because they didn't feel good about it. And there were lots of other things they were doing in relationship they didn't feel good about it, good about either. And they exhibited a conflict between their desire and their ego needs. Now, Michelle's book talks about this, and she's, I think, aware that she's reflecting something like psychoanalytic theory in talking about the conflict, which is not unique to women. I think partly a social opinion is that women experience a similar conflict as men do around their sexuality, just perhaps on another level because of the stigmas that are assigned to them. The conflict, on the one hand, you want to indulge your desire, you want to indulge your sexuality, your drive. At the same time, you want to retain your good image in the world, with your loved ones, with the community, society, etc. You want to remain a good woman or a good girl if it's happening earlier. And this is analogous to the male figure who also comes into my office and feels the same impetus to be secretive, you know, in their behaviors. There's no essential difference in this bit. It's just a matter of degrees, perhaps. You know, there's no one's proud per se, or few people are proud of being unfaithful or being anything like a sex addict. In fact, they feel, you know, very guilt-ridden and ashamed of these things. It's just a conflict between desire and the need they feel that they've internalized from family and beyond the culture to restrain themselves in order to achieve something else they want, namely good standing with loved ones and the community as a whole. The women that have come to me, if they are feeling that intense conflict on another level, it is perhaps influential in the phenomenon that Michelle draws so much attention to in her book. They are leaving relationships, perhaps, before the discovery event happens. Hence the bit about, you know, initiating divorce. And in her book, what she does, I hadn't mentioned this in the first podcast, she spends a lot of time, or most of the time actually, in dialogue with a man who had whose wife he believes may be having an affair, but he's also sort of in denial about that. So the book is a dialogue between Michelle, the sort of the treating figure, and this man who is at turns, you know, jealous, heartbroken, angry, clueless. Among the things that I also experience is that the women who talk to me historically about their secretive sexual behavior were very secretive about it. They didn't necessarily feel good about it. One thing that does contrast them in my experience with men is that they found it relatively easy to be secretive. And the reason they found it relatively easy is because of men's credulity, basically, about their monogamistic nature, you know, their essential virtue. You know, what women who are engaging in problem sexual behaviors can perhaps more readily take advantage is men's belief that they, meaning women, are not inclined towards promiscuity, or not as inclined as men are, so they don't as readily suspect it. Now, there are plenty of relationships where the opposite may be true, and I'm sure plenty of women experience that, the very jealous boyfriend and all the rest, which leads to, you know, controlling behaviors. Interestingly enough, I've not come across quite so many of that. And I think it may have something to do with the era in which I am treating men and women in psychotherapy, in-depth psychotherapy. It's an era in which I observe men to be more passive, perhaps, than their forebears were. More in denial in the ways that Michelle Langley writes about in that book. Making more assumptions and actually fielding in their relationships quite a lot of blame and feeling quite inadequate themselves. And this is something the female patients of mine talk about, that they actually feel guilty about. They've done a lot of blaming their typically male partners in the midst of their, you know, what in Freudian language you call their acting out patterns. They've experienced and exhibited a lot of contempt even towards, you know, their male partners. They've blamed them for a lot of relational problem, been irritable with them while they were acting out and pursuing other relationships, or at times using pornography or masturbating privately more than they were, you know, letting on, of course. And this speaks to something that I talk a lot about with my patients, you know, generally. Just a sideline of the idea of guilt and anger living very close to one another. Now, conventional wisdom is, guilt is something you feel in the aftermath of, say, the expression of a forbidden desire or the expression of aggression, like anger. But what we are aware of in the unconscious, and if we think about it, we can be more aware of in our day-to-day lives, is that anger and guilt live in a kind of cyclic relationship to one another, with anger often preceding guilt as well as following guilt. Anger as a defense against guilt, guilt as a defense against anger. And what do I mean by defense? I mean that which, you know, protects the self from a worse feeling. We defend in order to alleviate pain. We feel guilty to reduce the pain of having done harm or done something forbidden. We engage in anger to deflect our attention, to turn away from our guilt. Now, what we think is the right thing to do, the superego thing to do in psychoanalytic terms, or if you're religious, you might just think that the plainly correct thing to do, is to, you know, feel guilt or a version of guilt, which is remorse, apologize and be available for forgiveness and, you know, heal and move on. People who engage, particularly unconsciously, in guilt-ridden behaviors, is that their anger serves as a signifier of a guilt and also a concealer of their guilt. So, and we kind of know this intuitively, which is my earlier point. You know, a child who is having a tantrum, the tendency is to think, well, I wonder if they've done something wrong, and that's the reason they're having a tantrum. You know, when somebody is in a bad mood, meaning they're being irritable or angry, we sometimes do imagine that they feel guilty, and unwittingly we are aware of this idea that, again, anger can be used as a defense against guilt. I noticed this in particular with the women I spoke to about, you know, either sex addiction or problem sex behaviors. They would be very angry and contemptuous of their particularly male partners, and they would find it relatively easy for them to dodge away from confrontations by acting in a blaming way. And if the partner would become passive, which often was the case, the anger towards them would sort of proceed to contempt. They would hold them in contempt for believing in the lies, in the secrets. In part because it would make them feel even more guilty, you know, for having behaved that way. So it became a kind of vicious cycle. Now, there are a lot of different angles that people talk about with respect to the problem of, you know, women's behavior problems, sexual behavior being having different consequences, you know, to that men experience. And, you know, a lot of these things are indeed true, that, you know, women talk more openly about being worried about getting pregnant. They talk about as much as men who are, you know, sexually active about the problem of getting STDs. Women who are sexually active, they worry about the prospect of being assaulted, about being physically vulnerable in general when active sexually. But perhaps somewhat surprisingly, they talk about as much as men do, and again in my experience, about the problem of feeling rejected. Now, sideline here to take what I think is a typical cultural point of view that, the promiscuous male takes a kind of numbers approach, it's said, towards making advances towards women. You know, he comes to expect the women to be demure, to act like they're, you know, good girls, to borrow that term from earlier, and to be libidinally restrained. That's what I get for imposing myself multisyllabic words. Anyway, and so they come to expect rejection. You know, they don't like rejection necessarily, but they will tolerate it, perhaps, the would-be philandering, you know, promiscuous male. Women who are this way face a lot of rejection too, and that goes against what is a cultural expectation, because the cultural belief is that men will simply be appreciative of women making advances towards them, and they will happily, you know, cooperate with the sexual act if being invited. Well, this isn't necessarily the case. And it's something that I think Michelle Langley writes about a little bit in her book as well. Men, for whatever reason, you know, I could go into it, I don't want to make too much focus here on male psychology, don't necessarily like it, you know, when women take the initiative and make the advances, particularly if they are direct and boldly sexual. It can be exciting, but also can be sort of untrustworthy, as we hear women talk about quite a bit. And so the women that I've talked to who have invited sexual activity, particularly with men, and who have engaged in a lot of promiscuous relationships, talk about the problem of feeling rejected quite a lot, actually. And in feeling thereafter not necessarily contempt for those partners, but ashamed of themselves, might do the same kind of escapist behaviors that we attribute to male sex addicts, using porn a lot. And using porn, you know, this touches on the theme that I brought up at the end of the last podcast, only several hours ago now, which has to do with addiction, or things that are addictive at least, becoming habit-forming, having two poles to it. You know, it's the idea that it's pleasure-seeking, of course. Pleasurable behavior, sex, and stimulating dopamine release and all that. But at the same time, it's some manner of escape, we understand, culturally and, you know, popularly. It is a kind of soothing, and a soothing of a negative feeling state like embarrassment or shame. It is an avoidance of something that is uncomfortable. And I think this is something that female women have talked to me about privately, of course, multiple times. They feel rejected, and they feel rejected in their committed relationships as well. They feel like their partners don't understand their needs, or that their partner might think that their needs are too much or are too demanding, you know, too specific. You know, they worry about they're going to, you know, trigger the performance anxiety of their partners. And they don't want to shame or, you know, induce guilt in their partners necessarily. There's all sorts of reasons why sex in a committed relationship gets avoided, and it inclines people towards, you know, affairs or even transactional sex because it seems easier. It seems like a guilt-free experience. You know, we avoid to protect both ourselves and other people from relationship. And these women, they've been unhappy in these primary relationships. They've felt lonely. They have felt that their sexual needs are misunderstood and they're having affairs or they're using porn, they're masturbating a lot as a way of coping with the problem feelings that are emerging. They feel guilty about lying. They feel guilty about manipulating. One of the things that is slightly funny, not slightly, why is it slightly? It's very funny, but difficult to read, actually, in Michelle Langley's book, is this idea of the blowjob equaling flowers in the relationship dynamic back and forth, that men use flowers traditionally as a form of apology or seduction, I would argue. You know, one of the theories that psychoanalysis, I think, offers, also a bit cheekily, is the idea that we, flowers represent a reaction formation, a reversal, as the theory goes. You give flowers to the person you wish to deflower. Gestures, romance is meant to sort of clean things up, so to speak. Well, blowjob is the example of the apology behavior, the I want something behavior. I'll give something you want, what men want, and you'll get something in return. I've heard women and men speak of this, and to echo something that I'm saying earlier, the women I speak to are very clear on, you know, the purpose of the behavior as a manipulation. They feel guilty about it. It doesn't stop them doing it, but they feel guilty about it. The men are sort of aware too, perhaps a little bit less so. You know, what's it like for these women to talk to a male, you know, therapist? Because that's what I'm saying lots of them have done with me. It's interesting, they tend not to want to go into support groups with other women. Often the men that come to speak to me, I'm often suggesting they enter a men's support group of other, you know, promiscuous men or sex addicts or even love addicts. You know, I even run one or two of such groups. Don't run any such groups for women. So the women I speak to, they do imagine that men, including myself, will be, you know, shocked because, you know, we're so unknowing, really, and misunderstanding about their sexuality. But they find other women to be more judgmental, actually. And so they even more hesitant to speak to other women, about it. Even though some of them have found, you know, pockets of like-mindedness and pockets of like-mindedness that have interesting elements to them. For example, one thing I've always wondered about is what do women talk about when they get together and they're kind of assured of the, you know, privacy of their conversation, coming back to, you know, that dual desire. You want to have fun and exhibit your desires and so on, but you also still have an ego and you want to be thought of as a, you know, good girl, all of that business we spoke of earlier. So how do you find those women that are with whom you're going to share your naughty thoughts and so on, including your humor, and not get judged as being a slut or a nymphomaniac or whatever the terms are that we think are, you know, even more stigmatizing of women than, I guess, terms like dog and pig and whatever epithet comes to mind that society directs at, you know, men who are promiscuous. By implication, it's not as bad, although to the naked ear it sounds, you know, doesn't sound that far off, does it? You know, slut, pig, whatever. Anyway, I'm speaking of when, you know, women talk to each other. And this is something that these women have spoken to me. They talk about with each other the poor performance of their partners or the lesser endowments of their partners. Now, I have to admit, this is difficult to listen to, but I'm honoring that I'm being shared with about things which people are entrusting me, and that tends to govern my feelings in these situations. But again, it goes against a kind of commonplace chestnut, because the reputation of men in society is that men will, speak badly, sometimes in public or semi-public ways, the social media cruelty, that comments on the physicality of women, whereas we think it rare, except perhaps in the spirit of revenge, for, women to be speaking publicly about physical characteristics that would be shaming of their male partners. In this way, the women I speak to, whether they identify as addicts or not, they both feel guilty and it's a little bit sheepish, but they're also aware of how they've been able to sort of take advantage of the denial, of women's sexuality, which has layered meaning. This podcast maybe to an end with, a little vignette that sort of captures what I'm talking about. A woman is talking about reflecting when she was a young woman, a 20-something, who was going to break up, with her boyfriend. And she's felt guilt for many years because this boyfriend that she broke up with in her early 20s was kind of a friend to her father, who she also was looking to bond with. This father liked this boyfriend of hers. They went fishing together, things like that. Sounds like a kind of cliche, really. Anyway, the reason she was breaking up with the boyfriend after several years was that he was sexually inadequate. Now, the father, disappointed in the breakup, had imagined all sorts of reasons why his daughter was breaking up with the young man that he liked. And he imagined several reasons, some of which were sort of starting to get him angry, because he imagined that possibly, was that boyfriend whom he liked even abusive to his daughter. God help him if that had been the truth. The one thing that didn't occur to him, or didn't seem to occur to him, was the notion that this boyfriend was not meeting her sexual needs. Interesting that this patient was speaking in her treatment about the longing for to be honest about things. I will perhaps have more on the subject of this. This is enough again for now. I feel like I can get to the half-hour point. This has been part two, and maybe there'll be more to come on the subject of female sex addiction or problem sexual behaviors. Thanks again for listening. This is Graham Daniels, co-author of Getting Real About Sex Addiction, published by Roman and Littlefield. Talk to you again soon.